The Guardian.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Here, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Here newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. It was supposed to be a reshuffle to freshen up the cabinet. Instead, Theresa May had an education secretary storming off to the backbenches, the wrong chairman accidentally announced on Twitter, and others in the cabinet facing her down and refusing to budge. Now, as the dust has settled, we'll pick through who ended up where and why. Also this week, it's one of the most fashionable ideas in progressive politics, so how seriously should we take the idea of a universal basic income? We'll hear from Finland, where a national trial is underway, and from our experts on both sides of the fence. But first, it's normally about this point in January that New Year's resolutions go out the window and normal service resumes. So it proved for the Prime Minister this week, as her finely crafted reshuffle met with resistance and ridicule in a two-day slog to reassemble her team. Anushka Astana was down in Westminster watching it all on Monday as the debacle began, and she's here with me now. Let's just remind people why she needed to do this, Anushka.
Why did she need to do this? This is a very good question. I think that Theresa May has been resisting a reshuffle for quite a long time because her advisers said to her, you're going to cause yourself a nightmare because for every person that you please, there's going to be a dozen more that you annoy, not just the ones you sack, but also the ones you overlook. So there had been that resistance. And then Gavin Williamson, her former chief whip, basically left, became defence secretary, and the voices around her became a bit bolder and said, actually, you know what, you're in a stronger position now, you finished the first part of this Brexit negotiation, now's the time to try and assert your authority. One way to do that is to change your top team and show that you are strong. It didn't quite work out like that.
No, it was an awkward day, wasn't it? We'd also been promised appointments early on and it took longer than it should have done, and at one point Jeremy Hunt was holed up in Downing Street for a considerable length of time, wasn't it? What were the things that sort of went awry?
Well, let's see what she was originally trying to do. So as we understand it, it was less reshuffle, more shuffle, to be quite frank, because the only plans appear to be, let's swap Jeremy Hunt and Greg Clark from
He's the business secretary, to health.
Move Justine Greening to DWP, move David Gawke to justice, and open up a space at education, which was going to go to Damien Hines. They weren't actually going to sack anyone at all, and it was hardly a refresh. But what went wrong was, I mean, because of this weird convention that you have to do it without telling anyone in advance anything, or, you know, checking out what ministers might think, and also that you have to parade everyone down the road so that all the reporters know exactly when they entered Downing Street, we had this bizarre situation where Jeremy Hunt is able to spend 56 minutes persuading Theresa May, actually, hang on, don't move me, let me stay and give me a beefed up role. And then that has knock-on effects. In goes Greg Clark. Suddenly, he's just business secretary, as he was. And Justine Greening, well, she was nearly there for 3 hours before she actually refused that move. And probably because I think it is true that the move was a bit of a slight to Justine Greening. They weren't happy with what she was doing at education. I mean, when we were writing about it, I read back one of Alistair Campbell's, the former Labour spin doctor's diary, and he compared reshuffles to childbirth, dentistry and exams. Now,
Ooh. Yeah,
I'm not sure I'd put childbirth with dentistry, but that aside, the point he was making was you always forget how painful they're going to be until you're in the middle of them.
And what about these failures to sort of sound people out? I mean, I seem to remember at one point Gordon Brown was talking about or thinking about moving Alistair Darling. And I think he sent emissaries to talk to Alistair Darling and say, you know, do you fancy a move? And the answer came back, no. Why was Jeremy Hunt not asked or sounded out about this, you know, and why were all the papers writing for several days beforehand that Justine Greening, you know, wasn't great at her job and was going to be sacked?
Well, I think that to some extent they don't want to do it because they're really worried about leaks. So they want to keep it really tight. They want to kind of spring a surprise on someone. They almost see it as the media strategy is going to be more powerful if you do it in that way. But the problem is, if you're not actually strong, if you're not actually in a position to say to Jeremy Hunt, you're moving and you're not going to be able to persuade me otherwise, then I think it's a pretty risky strategy. And although I don't think Number 10 actually did the pre-briefings, which turned out to be largely wrong, what they didn't do is knock them down. So, you know, these stories were running all week about Greg Clark, about Justine Greening and so on. You know, had Justine Greening not gone into that Downing Street room annoyed about the fact that she'd been briefed against for a week, maybe, just maybe, she would have been more open to take the role.
Mm. And does it tell us, does this newly not very refreshed cabinet as it is now, tell us anything more about Theresa May's domestic agenda? Because that's the other thing they want to do in the new year, isn't it? Is kind of get back on track, the idea that you know, she's interested in things other than Brexit. She's interested in the environment. She's giving a big speech today. She wants to talk about schools. She wants to talk about other things. Does it give any sense of what she's about to any extent?
Well, this is the thing I find a bit odd. To some extent, that's what her aim was. She wanted to focus in particular on these areas, things like the environment, schools, standards, things like the NHS. And yet, how does a reshuffle actually achieve that? Because to most people, I don't think they care whether it's Jeremy Hunt or Greg Clark at the head of the business department. I don't think they really know whether Justine Greening or Damien Hines should be in charge of schools. I think what they really care about are what are those departments doing. And the problem you've got is that this churn that they're going through with the reshuffle, if anything, might suggest that you care a bit less about those domestic areas than people might hope to. So, for example, you know, they've got their third Justice Secretary in a couple of years. Well, I was talking to someone in the sector about that, and they said, well, there are some good policies underway. The thing that is frustrating is that the civil servants stop talking to the sector and that basically decisions are put on hold. How is that saying to people, the domestic agenda is what I care about?
And something incredibly complicated like DWP, you know, David Gort was just getting his head around universal credit, which is incredibly complex, and was starting to come out fighting, wasn't he, and sort of defend the government, not allow Labour to just attack universal credit. Off he goes to do a completely different job.
And you know, universal credit, I mean, you know, Heather, you understand it, but it takes a long time to understand the complexities of the policies at DWP. If you keep changing the person in charge, what are you saying to people? Are you saying that, you know, actually the delivery of this isn't as important as you think? I mean, I suspect what she was trying to do was to move people who she was slightly less impressed by, Greg Clark and Justine Greening, out of departments that are very important to her, because at Bayes they have industrial strategy, and in education, a lot of those Tory reforms that they were really keen about. And perhaps they thought, well, DWP is a delivery department, so it doesn't really matter who's in charge of it, and Greg Clark is a safe pair of hands at health. But overall, all she's ended up with are bad optics on the first day of a reshuffle that was supposed to relaunch her premiership.
Day two went a little bit more smoothly, didn't it? This was the more junior ranks, and we saw quite a few new faces, a lot of new faces come through. Few more women, few more BME candidates. Did that make you feel a little bit more like she was interested in diversity? This was another thing she talked about the reports have talked about in the run-up to the reshuffle.
Yeah, well, Theresa May has been someone who has been spearheading Women to Win for the Tory party for many years. She clearly cares about that issue. She wanted to do what advisers say is, you know, kind of boost the talent pipeline, people who will then be ready for cabinet in the future. And although overall people will laugh, the figures don't change that much. You get 7 extra women, a few extra ethnic minorities. Actually, to make that change in one reshuffle, you actually have to be fairly dramatic about the decisions that you make. There were a number of ethnic minority Tory MPs who were promoted, and I think 16 women altogether who were promoted. You know, I think the Daily Mail described it as the massacre of white middle-aged men. Not quite massacre. I think they still are a massive majority when it comes to the ministers in our government. And, you know, I've long said that the women and the ethnic minority MPs are incredibly talented and sometimes think they have to fight harder to get to where they are. So there is no, you know, compromise on ability. The thing that frustrates me slightly about these things are, you know, this is Theresa May's third reshuffle. Admittedly, her last one was pretty limited. You know, when is this talent pipeline actually going to be ready? David Cameron has been talking about this since 2012. I think we're going to have a lot of very good mid-rank ministers and a very white and very privileged-looking cabinet for quite a while.
Yeah, and the cabinet looks very similar to at the start of the week, doesn't it? Although there are a couple of names that are being talked about. I noticed Michael Gove is now suddenly tipping Damien Hines, the new Education Secretary, as a potential future Prime Minister. Is that plausible? We met Damien Hines not so long ago. He was employment minister, wasn't he? Is he?
Yeah, I mean, did you think immediately he could be the next leader? I mean, it's interesting because most people don't have a clue who Damien Hines is, and they'll be quite interested to see how he does. He obviously was fairly steady in charge of Universal Credit as employment minister. I do think it's quite funny how suddenly you're hearing all this, because basically, what are they doing? They are preparing for Theresa May's succession. We all know she's unlikely to take the Tory party into the next election. And so now you kind of need to gear up to get some of the people in position who might be the ones who take over. I don't know enough about Damien Hines to be quite clear why Michael Gove is backing him, but I do wonder if the fact that they've put him at education, we know that Theresa May's former advisor, Nick Timothy, was very passionate about free schools and grammar schools, which, as we know, has had to be put on hold. I wonder if they hope that he is going to seize back up those Tory reforms again. But, you know, that might be a problem for the sector, which actually quite liked Justine Greening, because for once she managed to hold off Downing Street and let schools, you know, just have that tiny bit of breathing space.
They really liked her. Talking of the massacre of the middle-aged white men. One middle-aged white man who had to give up his post. White man who had to give up this post this week was Toby Young, wasn't it? who was briefly appointed to the board of the Office for Students.
Yeah, and that did feel like a massacre in some way, because as soon as he got that appointment, my goodness, did we all get a big reminder about the stupid things that Toby Young had said over the years. When I was reading some of the tweets about comments he'd made about breasts or lesbians or whatever else it was, I literally had to ring someone up and say, "Are these fake?" Because I honestly couldn't believe that somebody could have been quite so vile. And the extraordinary thing is that he waits to quit until the government sends out a minister, at the time Higher Education Minister Jo Johnson, not anymore, in order to defend him the day before he quits. And of course, Heather, you had a brilliant exclusive on that day, which is so telling. The Tories even sent out to their own MPs a kind of guidebook as to how to defend Toby Young in Parliament.
With sort of helpful notes on all the outrageous things Labour MPs had said in the past.
I think it's pretty bad when basically your defence manual doesn't give you a single line of defence. It only offers you attacks. It's saying, we know he's bad, but we think you're worse. It's been very, very embarrassing. And as for Toby Young, I think he probably wishes it never got offered to him in the first place.
I'm sure he does. One last thing. Is Theresa May any stronger as a result of this week? Is she any weaker? Or are we pretty much where we were? How long can she last out?
Well, I think in terms of the week itself, especially when you're in the middle of it, you have to say that an attempt to reassert her authority has absolutely backfired. And from that point of view, she does look weaker. And clearly the optics of reshuffles are, you know, something that are very important. That said, these things always feel worse at the time than they do a few weeks down the line. A few weeks down the line, what is going to be really interesting is, what is Estimate Vey actually doing at DWP? What is Damien Hines doing at education? And that is where Theresa May will hope to focus her energy. And then starting today, as you say, with the environment speech, although already I noticed that her former advisor, Katie Perrier, said that although she doesn't think that it's not genuine, she'd certainly never heard enthusiasm about the environment from the Prime Minister before.
Anoushka, thanks very much. Now, one of the most talked about ideas in progressive politics right now is the universal basic income, which has been catching the attention of everyone from Silicon Valley billionaires to Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. As inequality rises up the political agenda and automation threatens middle-class jobs, should governments consider raising taxes, scrapping welfare, and instead pay everyone a guaranteed basic income? It may sound like the stuff of radical socialism, but the centre-right government in Finland is among the first to roll out a trial. And earlier I spoke to one of the leaders of the programme in Helsinki, Maiju Kurttunen.
We selected 2,000 people from the group of all people who received basic unemployment benefit in November 2016, and that's altogether 177,000 people. And that was a random selection that we made. You know, we put a programming code into the computer and picked them up, these 2,000 people.
So they now receive their payments regularly and irrespective of whether they can show that, for example, they've been looking for a job or they don't have to jump through any hoops now to get that money?
No, they don't. They don't have to report us or anything in order to get these 560 euros of this basic income. But of course, if they want to apply for another benefit, for example, housing allowance or so on, so they have to report all their, you know, earnings and what job they have been doing and how much work they have been doing.
Right. And tell us a bit about the rationale for this, because, you know, we've been talking about the discussion here about universal basic income and the fact that there are different justifications for it. Is this about simplifying the benefits system? Is it about allowing people to take a different approach to work? What was the thinking behind it?
Well, there are a few of the reasons that we wanted to, you know, check out with this experience. The one that our government wants to see is the kind of like the point that of the work life today. So we want to see if this kind of mechanism increases the incentive for people to take on work. And the problem is that we have incentive traps in our unemployment benefit system that in some situations it's not worthwhile for you to take on work because you end up with less money when you would be fully unemployed. So that's one reason that we are doing this experiment. But of course, we see a lot of we get a lot of information from this experiment in order to harmonize our social security system and reform it. And actually, our government has started it already. So we have been starting a big reform that we want to, you know, renew our social security system. So we are thinking of that already now.
Mm. And are you able to, I think the trial period is not yet over, is it? Are you able to get a sense yet of how well this is working?
Not yet, because, of course, we have been getting feedback from the customers, but it's kind of like single customers calling us and so on. So we don't want to make any conclusions about that. That a single person, you know, giving us feedback, and we have to wait for the end of this experiment. So we're in the end of this year, and after that we make the analysis. And we are gathering the information about these people and what they're doing, but we don't have the information yet to make the final analysis. How is it working? So we don't know that yet.
Sure. But it very much sounds as though what you're not expecting them to do is sort of, you know, sit at home and whatever, write poetry or, you know, have leisure time. You're hoping it helps them to move in and out of the labour market.
Yes, of course. We hope that most of them will get work and will try to find work. And lots of them have been kind of like informing us that they are really happy with this mechanism, and I hope that that's a sign for this positive impact on this experiment. But of course, there are some people who will just, you know, I think that the money side is not the only side that we have to consider, because it's also a matter of how you are supported to find work. Where do you find the work? Are you living in a city or in a place that there is work? And so there are lots of other things that you have to consider. And I think that some people, you know, they need some services more than they need the money. So the free money, unconditional money, is not the answer for every problem.
Mm. And you're not suggesting taking away those services or sort of handing a check to these people and then just leaving them to fend for themselves?
No. I think that some people will activate and motivate themselves with this kind of mechanism, and this is the right way to go with them. But there are lots of people who don't, you know, understand the clue, or they just take the money and they stay home, and they need something, and they need some kind of other push from the service system or some other kind of like action in order for them to activate and motivate themselves into studying or into rehabilitation or whatever. It's the right way to go with them.
Maijukka Turunen there from the Finnish welfare agency Kela in Helsinki. Well, I'm joined now in the studio by our expert panel, Torsten Bell, Director of the Resolution Foundation, Neil Lawson, Chair of the think tank Compass, and Sonia Soda, Chief Leader Writer at The Observer. Neil, you're an advocate for this idea. Tell us, just set out for us briefly what a universal basic income is.
Well, it's pretty much what it says on the tin. It's an amount of money that every citizen gets as of right. And the important bit is of everyone getting it and the unconditionality. So you don't have to pass any tests. You don't have to be looking for work. You don't have to do anything to get it. And it's an idea that's as old as the hills, and it's been knocking around for quite a long time. And it's getting more and more coverage, I think, for two reasons. Firstly, because of the worry about automation and, you know, a big net loss in jobs. But that isn't the reason that I come to it, because I can't predict the future and I don't know how many, you know, what the job displacement is going to be. I think it's more on the agenda, certainly for me and Compass, because our welfare system now isn't working. Our welfare system was set up in order to cater for a world in which mostly men went to work for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and did one job for life. And now, because of the complexity of the labour market, we're trying to change the welfare system to match that complexity, and it can't do it. And all we're doing really is humiliating and hurting people at the kind of lower ends who have got precarious work, and trying to fit them into a model that just isn't there anymore. And I think we should wipe the slate clean. And there are figures we can go through in a while to show that it's quite easy to start putting a kind of solid foundation under people to give them the security to do the work they want to do, to live the life they want to live, or start to anyway. I think that's the reason why there's huge excitement about this issue.
And just give us a sense of, you said go through the numbers later and you're right, but let's just give us a sense of the scale of this. So are we talking about the kind of income that someone could live on?
Well, there are different models and different things are being worked out. So at the moment, there are trials going on all over the world, and trials are going to start in this country as well. The Scottish government's just put 250 million aside for, I think, three councils to begin to kind of do little micro trials of citizens' income. In terms of the numbers, you can start with, you know, we've run some figures which are a kind of looking at kind of 70 odd, £75 a week for people, which isn't transformative, but establishes the principles. And we've run kind of tax and benefit changes, which mean you could do that by hitting the people at the upper end of the tax level, you know, somewhat in order to pay. So there's no net increase for the Exchequer to pay everyone around kind of £70 a week. But we're also now beginning to trial to work out how you could accelerate that over 10 years to a near or, you know, or full, you know, nearly full scheme of which people could pay for their heating, the roof over their head, and their food. You know, the kind of 250 odd pounds a week, that, you know, that kind of figure. So we're beginning to work out how that could be paid for.
And what kind of tax rise are we talking about to pay for that 70 odd quid a
week?
I'm
not the economist on the team, and we can dig the figures out. I think the people in the top 25% would pay, you know, somewhat more, but I mean not eye-wateringly more, but somewhat more in order to help the people at the bottom and make sure that, you know, there weren't any kind of losers at the bottom of the income chain.
Torsten, it sounds very simple. We know the economy is changing a lot because of automation. We know the welfare system has got more and more complex, and we know conditionality, where, you know, claimants have to jump through lots of hoops to get their payments, is a great problem for a lot of people. This sounds like a nice clean solution, doesn't it?
Well, it's definitely clean. I mean, I think the first thing to say is obviously there are, you know, there's a lot of problems with the status quo, as anyone living in 21st century Britain recognises, from the nature of the benefit system to the world of work. And so there's those problems, and different problems are the priority for different people, are the kind of root cause of the energy and excitement that has been around UBI. Although I'd slightly say, without wanting kind of to do down the fact that we're doing this podcast, it's a bit like kind of Trump's wall or Leicester City. But my personal view is probably the issue is slightly on the kind of fading side of things. But, you know, let's see where the trials go. But the key benefit from it is, whether the issue is kind of coming or going, is that it does trigger debate, and it should force people to decide what is it they really care about. What is it of the arguments that are out there that people use for a UBI that is most important to you? And then even if you can't get your UBI, what is your policy change that would help you make progress on that? Is it that you want a simpler benefit system? Is it actually not simplicity, but you want a more redistributive tax and benefit system? Is it actually that you want more cash transfers and less money spent on public services, which is what a lot of the original arguments for UBI came from? Is it that you, in brackets, wrongly think that all the jobs are going to go because the robots are about to turn up, and you manage to think that at the same time as that Britain has the highest level of employment in our history? In that one, it's not decided different. It's just like, get right. Stop thinking the wrong thing. But for the others, you could decide what's important to you and then get on with some policy that affects that.
Right. So there are alternatives, you think, to this kind of all-embracing approach?
I think I'm just more in practice saying, it's a really good thought experiment. It will help you clarify in your mind what's important to you. It's not going to happen. And so all I'm saying is for those people engaged in like domestic politics and thinking today about things that can happen, it's not useless to you as a thought experiment, because it'll help you decide what you do want to see happen in the near future. And I think, although it's a good thing to have that thought experiment, the slight danger of it that I slightly worry about, particularly on the left today, is that it takes up all the energy and the space that could be spent on worrying about things that are in practice happening now. So, for example, should we be worrying about whether we need a UBI tomorrow to deal with there being no jobs, or should we be spending every waking hour thinking how are we going to improve the world of work for people today? How are we going to make sure that our benefit system is generous enough for those on lower incomes so they have a decent standard of living? And it mustn't get in the way of those debates, it must enable them.
Sonia, I'm going to come to you, but Neil, it sounds as though you're spending a lot of time advocating the equivalent of Donald Trump's wall. It's sort of yesterday's idea.
Well, it was yesterday's idea, and it's today's idea, and it's going to be tomorrow's idea as well. It's incredible the amount of articles, people coming out of it, you know, Zuckerman, Hillary Clinton, you know, there's loads of people that are coming out and looking at this, and they're doing so for a reason. And that's why it's so fascinating, because, you know, Torsten went through all the reasons why you might kind of, you know, be interested in it. And all those things are right, because it opens up a huge debate about what the future of society is, what the good life is. And that's why I think it's so brilliant. And I agree with Torsten that I'm not so wedded to the idea or any policy idea that I'm going to die in a ditch for it. And I don't think UBI is a silver bullet or a panacea. But it does enable you to have that brilliant conversation about what the good society and the good life is in a way that no other policy idea does. And I think, you know, we're at the foothills of trying to work through, you know, the numbers and how it could be done. But when Torsten says it won't happen, well, they said the NHS wasn't going to happen. They said that was impossible. They said the minimum wage was impossible. They said the living wage was impossible. People always say things are impossible until they're possible. And we know that the kind of world of work and the world of welfare are just colliding, you know, and we're going to have to think of something else. Maybe the answer isn't universal basic income. Maybe it's universal basic services. Maybe it's something else. I'm happy to have that conversation. But we've really got to keep this debate alive, open, because it's the one thing. That's why we're sitting around this table and why everyone's talking about it, because it is such an imaginative, transformative idea. Of course, let's critique it, but let's really allow it to flourish.
Sonia, you've been to Finland and looked at their experiment there, and you've spent quite a lot of time thinking about this idea.
Yeah, and I started off with quite an open mind. In fact, you know, Neil said it's been around for a long time. I first came across the idea in a political theory seminar about 15 years ago, and I quite liked the idea back then. So I started the work I've done on this. I made a radio programme, been to Finland, as you said, with quite an open mind. But I've become increasingly sceptical the more that I've thought about it and the more I think about its application to the real world in the here and now. And that's because there are sort of two main categories of argument that people sort of couch the argument for universal basic income in. One is, as Neil said, reform of the benefit system and the welfare state. And I actually agree with Neil. I think there are loads of problems in the way that our means-tested benefit system is working in the here and now. But I don't think universal basic income is a solution to those. And that's because our benefit system is means-tested. It's very focused on targeting at families with the most needs. And that's, you know, generally families with young children. Now, if you move to universal basic income, you either have to start paying everyone at the level which you pay families with children, you top up wages for, you know, families in low income work with children, or you pay it at a much lower level, in which case you don't fix the problems that come with means testing and the benefit system. And there's so much reform you can do of the benefit system around conditionality and sanctions, the lack of support for people to move into jobs that are right for them, the lack of support that's to help people reskill. Those are all really important things, and a universal basic income doesn't fix that. The second category of arguments that people make for universal basic income are these sort of, you know, utopian, dystopian style arguments about work coming to an end. And, you know, Neil said that he's not going to predict the future, but the fact is that when you look back, people have been making these arguments since the year dot, whether it's, you know, the invention of the wheel, the washing machine, the PC. Oh my God, all the jobs are going to go and they're going to be replaced, and there isn't going to be enough work for everyone. That's never happened in the history of humankind. I don't think we're on the cusp of some technological wave that is so different from the ones that have gone before us. But I do think the world of work is changing very fast. And it is absolutely right that just as we lost jobs in the 1980s through deindustrialisation, we are going to be losing jobs to the next wave of technology. It's just that they're going to be replaced by other jobs. And the answer to that is not to say to people, well, sorry, your job's over now. Here's a bit of universal basic income for you. You'll just have to make do on, you know, £75 a week or £200 a week, whatever it is. The answer is to actually put thought into how you reskill people, because work is really important to people. It gives them a sense of dignity. And it's really fundamental to who we are as human beings. So to me, I think it's a nice theoretical idea. I agree that it's really helpful as a thought experiment. It's helped me think about what I think is important. And what I think is absolutely key when it comes to the world of work is thinking about how do we prepare for the jobs that we are going to lose and help people reskill for the new jobs that are going to be out there. And what do we do about this small slice of the labour market? It's not a huge slice. There's a small slice of the labour market, a small minority of jobs where there is increasing and pernicious insecurity. And the answer to that is not to pay people a universal basic income and say, hey, sorry, you've got to make do with 0 hours contract. It's to actually think about how we get security back into that slice of the labour market, because I believe it's something that people have a right to.
Neil, how do you answer that point about targeting? The means testing system is kind of cumbersome and tricky, and it has conditions, but it does allow more money to go to the people who have the greatest needs, whether that's having kids to bring up or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, and ultimately we want a level of UBI that did away with that. Now, so we've got to model the figures on that, but I think we're confident that we can arrive at that over a kind of, you know. So the idea is you introduce it at a kind of relatively low level, which still has some elements of complexity because there would need to be some means testing still, but you've established the principle, you can show it work, and then over 10 years you could begin to kind of develop it through different cohorts, different kinds of payments to different groups to begin to ratchet up so that everyone got a level of payment which enabled them to survive. But I think that the crucial, you know, one of the crucial issues is about the focus on work, and this idea that human beings were put on this planet to work 5 days a week, you know, 8 hours a day, and that's the only way that we get our purpose. You know, I would take issue with that. You know, the reason that we work for that, you know, in that way, in this shape and form, is because of the Protestant work ethic, because of the poor laws, and now because of consumerism, where we chase stuff that we didn't know we wanted with money we don't have to impress people we don't know. And I think we've got this is why universal basic income is so interesting, because it cracks open what is it to be a human being and how many days a week we want to work. You could combine a policy. If Labour went to the next election with a policy of a reasonable level of UBI plus a four-day week, I think we'd smash it. Because people don't want to work all hours. They want to do all sorts of different things. And UBI gives them both a platform to bargain more effectively in the labour market because they don't have to take low wages. And it says you don't have to work all the time if you don't want to. You can care for your kids. You can do, you know, local volunteering work. You know, you could read a book. You could, you know, and sometimes you could daydream a little bit, just like human beings have done for 98% of our existence, where we didn't work all the time, because that isn't what we're hardwired to do. We're hardwired to have enough and then do loads of other pleasurable things that make us fully flourishing human beings. And finally, the planet cannot sustain, a population that works and spends on the basis that we do. So we've got to find a different way of existing. And that's why UBI is so interesting, because it cracks open this conversation.
Sonia?
I think a four-day week is a lovely idea, but I just can't see how it would work. I mean, what's going to happen? Is the government going to say to firms, you're only allowed to employ people on a four-day contract? If you don't do that, I don't think it could work, because I don't think people are going to want to take voluntarily. I mean, I wouldn't, unless I had caring responsibilities, in which case I would speak to my employer about working flexibly. But I wouldn't want to be told, I'm sorry, you have to go down to 4 days a week, take a 20% pay cut, and by the way, here's a little bit of UBI just to make up for that 20% pay that you're missing. So I think it's a nice idea, but it's very utopian to think that we could get there.
Torsten, what do you think about the politics of it? You've spent a certain amount of time advising Labour politicians. The Labour Party is called the Labour Party because Labour traditionally believes in work, doesn't it? Yeah. And the dignity of that it brings.
And, it has definitely got a bit of what Neil says is the Protestant work ethic, probably without the Protestant bit of it so much these days. So that is definitely a big issue. I mean, stepping back from, I don't want to get into kind of prehistory and when people roamed with their animal skins on, but like if we step back, what is the long-term trend? The long-term trend is people actually choosing to work slightly less hours. Not in recent years. In recent years, people actually increased the number of hours they're working. But the longer term trend across the last 150 years is of hours being reduced. The shorter term trend is actually for higher paid people to actually had to work slightly more hours, particularly men, and lower paid people to have had their hours reduced, particularly men, and done more part-time work. Although actually they do that reluctantly. So the people that are upset about not being able to get more hours in today's labour market are lower paid men in particular. Now, some of that's to do with social norms, but some of that is to do with they'd like some more income, please. Now, could a universal basic income say to them, if you currently want more hours just because you want more money, not because you are worried about your social status and other things that come with work or spending time with your friends at work and other things, then could be part of the answer to that. All I would say is I think we should just be like the kind of universal basic income that really allows people not to work, or at least to significantly reduce their volume of work, is a massive deal. Mm. Like, and it's not about like
In terms of being very expensive.
It is billions
and billions.
Even just maintaining a currently in Britain very ungenerous level of minimum income, the kind of things that Neil's talking around, £75, is probably you're talking about needing to increase the share of taxation and spending, the economy, state spending in the economy, by something like 5% of GDP. So like £120-130 billion. So that's like the minimus. And if you didn't, you wouldn't want to do less than that because you'd be into reducing serious increases in
poverty. And what kind of tax increases are we talking about there? If you did that through...
That's like... that's 5% of GDP.
Jacking up income tax.
So, well, the top third of the population is probably like coughing up something like another 9 billion quid net. On top of getting basic income.
Well, we've got figures that show you can do that by rejigging the tax and benefit system. Yeah. So there is no net increase. And that hits the people at the top that we want to hit.
I've been through your figures. That's literally our day job. To do it with no net increase in... Now you mean there's no exchequer effect, yeah?
Yeah.
But spending goes up by 5% of GDP and tax goes up by 5% of GDP. Yeah. That's what the kind of... That's a really simple thing, yeah? That's like the most minor version of a UBI. The kind of thing you're talking about moving to over 10 years is of another order of magnitude entirely. To do anything like that without increasing poverty in Britain significantly requires, you know, a huge increase in taxation, not of the kind of magnitude I'm talking about here, but much bigger, and it has to be much more redistributive. Now, I'm massively in favour of a big shift towards redistribution. In fact, I'd like the Labour Party to be talking about that a bit more rather than a bit less. So that'd be a good thing, and I think there's actually a bit more of a market for that. The debate around welfare spending in the UK has started to move away from the Tories thinking that they can talk about scroungers and things, and I think people now get that most people on benefits are in work. They are the strivers, and cutting their benefits is not a very good idea, either substantively or politically. So I think we're kind of moving into a better place from a very low baseline. But what is the fundamental problem in Britain? Our benefit system is very unjust. Some of the ways it has worked, particularly some of the excesses of sanctions, have been very dehumanising for the people involved in it. And we're not doing enough to improve the nature of work. And that's what I would get on with doing.
And then there are other things as well. So if you're really going to invest, say, 20 billion in something in the here and now, I would argue we need to be looking at services, in particular, like services like social care, for example. For me, there's a much stronger argument for making free personal care available to everyone, like they have in Scotland, because we know, you know, care needs in retirement is not something that people save for in advance. So there's an even stronger case for making that free at the point of delivery than the NHS.
What about that, Neil? The better things you could do with the money?
Well, I think that's part of the debate. But I think what the listeners are hearing here is people coming at this conversation from two different ends of the telescope. You know, on the one side, there's a kind of like reformist, you know, let's keep tweaking the system. We can make it better. And I'm sure we can. We can improve it. I'm coming at it from the different end. I'm saying that I want to transform society. I want to live in a different kind of world. I don't want to live in this world. I don't want to live in a world of kind of overwork, stress, inequality, environmental destruction. And I want to move to a very different kind of living. And I think UBI is one of the ways in which you can do that. You know, because, you know, Sonia says that people want to work 5 days a week. Well, why don't they want to work more? Why don't we get rid of weekends? Why don't we just work all the time? Because we don't want to. I mean, Keynes predicted that we'd have solved the economic problem, the production and the distribution problem by now. And we've been predicting this leisure society. And the reason that it hasn't come around is because we're all on this stressful treadmill of thinking that we've got to own more and do more and be more, and it's kind of killing the planet, and it's kind of causing insecurity, and it's causing kind of all sorts of, you know, social and mental problems. And we've got to find ways out of that, you know, and UBI is the only policy idea that begins to transform us from a neoliberal, you know, inequality, climate, you know, change world to something that could be different. And that's why so many people are interested in
it. And how do you make that argument? I can see how you make that argument, you know, when Jeremy Corbyn's on the stage at Glastonbury, or to kind of younger, you know, to kids who are never going to be able to afford a home because the economy's not delivering for them. How do you make that argument to kind of small C conservative voters, you know, who think they're going to be subsidising hippies or whatever?
Well, because that is, I mean, all the evidence says that when you start giving people security, they start doing all sorts of different interesting things. You know, we're not hardwired to be just lazy and useless. We're hardwired to be creative and innovative, and that some of that will be work and some of that will be other things. I think those small C conservatives have got all the same insecurities about what's going to happen to their grandchildren, what's going to happen to the planet, what sort of world do they want to leave behind. And that's why people from the left and the right and the middle are interested in this conversation.
And just tell me where Labour are on this. So John McDonnell's looking at it, is he? Jonathan Reynolds, who's in the Shadow Treasury team, is
Yeah, there's definitely an openness. There's been talk about setting up a group to examine it more fully. I think that's, you know, hopefully that's going to happen. But the very fact that, you know, the Labour Party challenging for government is looking at this issue seriously tells us that it's an idea whose time has probably come.
Torsten, can you see the Labour Party adopting it?
Yeah, well, I think putting anything in 21st century British politics is a bad idea. So I can I definitely see it happening, yes. Is it a good thing that all parties, and particularly Labour Party, examine it, look at it, use it as a way of clarifying what they think about the future of 21st century Britain? That's a really good thing to do.
The Greens support it. The SNP support it.
Yep. Although the SNP are in government and they're not doing it, but
they're trialling it.
They're doing a tiny trial. But would it be? You know, if there's nothing wrong with that, that's a good thing. I just think that it should be a bit tough though on ourselves, because Neil is right to say one of the things we should think about is where is transformational change possible, and where is it? How does that compare to incremental change? Obviously, in lots of ways, if you can have a vision for a better society, and you should do that, and that should drive. My view is basically you should have that vision, and then it should drive lots of incremental changes across the piece, and use that over a period of time that gets you towards that status quo. But all I'm saying is that debate should be including universal basic income, but it can't involve bits of the conversation saying things like, we can have this, that means no one needs to work, and it costs any more, and nobody needs to pay any more apart from a tiny bit from some rich people you don't really need to meet. It's a big transformational change just because it is a big change, and you can't both have it as a there's no big trade-offs and it's all very simple and it would transform society.
And there are very big questions, I think, to be asked about whether it can achieve what people who, you know, who put it forward, like Neil, say it can achieve. And I think there are lots of debates to be had on a practical level. For example, you know, you look at something like tax credits, which is welfare that's paid out to people in work, in low-income work. They have been systematically eroded by Conservative governments in the last 8 years. And one of my concerns about something like universal basic income is it might get introduced and, you know, there are people in Silicon Valley who are massively in favour of it, like Mark Zuckerberg. And you can see why, because they want to move to a society where work becomes much less secure. You've got the Uber style model where you're shifting risk onto employees. It suits them. They want the state to pay out basic income. They don't want to pay for it. They don't want to pay the tax for it. And that's the problem. When you've got an economy in which power shifts to an increasingly concentrated number of people who own the robots, who own technology, the future of universal basic income, we might be putting it in their hands. And the idea that economic power is static and it's not dynamic and it doesn't change, and that this might not be at risk in the future, I think is quite naive.
Right, we're almost out of time. Neil, just go, last quick word to you. It could empower the Zuckerbergs of this world.
Well, that's an issue about democracy and power, and I think, you know, one of the things that universal basic income would do, it would be the biggest collective act of social solidarity, you know, the country or the world has ever done. And I think, you know, part of the reason why I support it, you know, universal basic income, or sometimes it's called citizens' income, we create citizens. We tell everybody, as of right, as of birth, you are valued. And you will have the time and the space to be a fully flourishing citizen, and you will have the support to do that, so that you are part of the democratic kind of fibre, you know, of the system. And at the moment, people don't have any time even to do that stuff. You know, we create people who feel like they're citizens so that they can act to take on the Facebook world and the Google world and whoever else, because they have the wherewithal, they have the subsistence, and they have the feeling that they are a citizen as of right, and they're supported by society, and their voice and their place matters. That's one of the big reasons, and so we can take on the kind of things that Sonia was talking about.
It's an uplifting note on which to end. That's all we have time for. Thank you all very much. Follow all the latest political news at theguardian.com and the exciting new redesigned, relaunched tabloid Guardian on Monday. But for now, my thanks to Neil Lawson, Torsten Bell, Sonia Soda, Mayuka Turunen and Anushka Astana. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.